I would also note that one of the things that the Borman Flight Capital Organization did very successfully was to acquire control over assets in the United States, and again, some of the cartel agreements between the major German corporations, which were the foundation of the Third Reich, and their American counterparts were profound. Of the Borman Flight Capital Organization's acquisitions in America, Manning writes, "Throughout this period of asset transfer, Reichsleiter Bormann's goal was to have as much foreign exchange as possible in position in all neutral nations in both hemispheres. Aside from the Swiss banks, which made all currencies readily available in exchange for goods, trade, or gold bullion sales, the export of German products to neutral nations added to the general foreign, added to the general foreign exchange funds. Upon receipt of German goods, an agency in Spain, for example the Spanish Foreign Exchange Institute, would credit pesetas to a German-controlled import-export company. With such funds accumulating rapidly in Spain, Portugal, Sweden, Switzerland, and Argentina, Bormann and his group, who were handling the fortunes of 750 new corporations, would use these corporations in neutral countries as cloaks for investing in American companies. Bormann always had a high regard for U.S. blue-chip stocks as a stable investment, consistently purchasing a vast number of shares from the European offices of such New York stock brokerage houses as Merrill Lynch on behalf of the Reich Chancellery and Hitler until war became official between the United States and Germany and the buying stopped for a time. In 1941, investments in U.S. corporations by German companies and assorted German individuals held voting ownership in 170, minority ownership was held in another 108 American companies. These businesses covered the following fields: manufacturing, foodstuffs, chemicals, electrical and automobile equipment, machinery and machine equipment, other metal products, petroleum production, refining and distribution, finance, trade, and miscellaneous. American industry, of course, had a financial stake in German industry. In the same year, 1941, 171 U.S. corporations had major investments in German firms amounting to $420 million. A listing of these corporations is identical to the general categories under German ownership in the United States. When Bormann gave the order for his representatives to resume purchases of American corporate stocks, it was usually done through the neutral countries of Switzerland and Argentina. From foreign exchange funds on deposit in Swiss banks and in Deutsche Südamerikanische Bank, the Buenos Aires branch of Deutsche Bank, large demand deposits were placed in the principal money center banks of New York City. National City, now Citibank, Chase, now Chase Manhattan N.A., Manufacturers and Hanover, now Manufacturers Hanover Trust, Morgan Guaranty, and Irving Trust. Bear in mind that Manning is writing here in 1981. Such deposits are interest-free, and the banks can invest this money as they wish, thus turning tidy profits for themselves. In return, they provide reasonable services such as the purchase of stocks and transfer or payment of money on demand by customers of Deutsche Bank, such as representatives of the Bormann business organizations and Martin Bormann himself, who has demand accounts in three New York City banks. They continue to do so. The German investment in American corporations from these sources exceeded $5 billion and made the Bormann economic structure a web of power and influence. Indeed, and again, I believe that ultimately, if the history of the world is ever properly written, I believe the Bormann Organization will prove to be the decisive element in human affairs, at least in the 20th and 21st centuries, and it is my analysis that the future ultimately will be theirs. We're going to continue with our analysis of the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, one of the most remarkable political, financial, and military achievements of all time, in the next half-hour segment. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening. Righty, you're listening to the KFJC Month of Mayhem Memorial Day Weekend, Uncle Sam and the Swastika Special, detailing the collaboration of U.S. corporations with the fascist powers of World War II and its political aftermath. By the way, when I talk about the Bormann Organization and say that I believe that it will prove to be the decisive element in human affairs, that's not what I want to happen. That's what I believe will happen, barring a drastic change. Obviously, I'm anti-fascist, not pro-fascist. However, I do think that barring a significant change, I believe that is what will happen. It's also something that listeners should get busy to try to prevent. Rather than complaining about my statement, I strive for accurate analysis on this program, not invective and not polemicization, if that's a word, I believe it is. this is something that people should work to try to prevent rather than complaining to me about my analysis. Nothing is etched in stone, and if enough people were to get busy and get the word out, who knows what might happen. Perhaps that my analysis could be proven wrong. I certainly hope it will be. In any event, broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC Los Altos Hills. What we're going to do next is to go to the next half hour of tonight's program. This is the concluding half hour of the two-part sequence on the Borman Organization proper. This next side is obviously a half hour in length. Those of you who are taping, please get ready to do so. 3, 2, 1, here we go. Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in this next half-hour segment, we're going to continue with our examination of the remarkable Borman Flight Capital Organization, the real story of the Nazi Flight Capital that has appeared in the popular news media in connection with the gold that has passed through Switzerland and other neutral countries at the end of the war. Again, that account is altogether attenuated into a serious student of the Second World War and its aftermath is somewhat amusing in its incompleteness. In our first segment, we examined the Borman Flight Capital Organization, headed up by the consummately powerful and brilliant Martin Bormann, the Reichsleiter, and initially Hitler's number two man, eventually the leader of the Third Reich itself, particularly when it went into its underground phase. Bormann convened a meeting in August of 1944 in which the top German industrial leaders were incorporated into a plan to secret the assets of the Third Reich abroad to prepare, and successfully so, I might add, for a German economic resurgence after the conclusion of military hostilities. 750 corporate fronts were set up to handle the transfer of these assets, which also was accomplished with the aid of the profound cartel connections between the major German corporations and their counterparts in other major countries, including and especially the United States. For our account of the Borman Organization, whose post-war operations we're now going to discuss, we relied on a remarkable book. That book is entitled Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, authored by Paul Manning, M-A-N-N-I-N-G. Manning was part of the CBS News team, which covered the Second World War, along with Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite. And he published this remarkable book, again, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart, copyright 1981. The ISBN number is 0-8184-0309-8. And in the preface to this book, he describes the remarkable Bormann Organization and its post-war influence. And as I indicated in the first segment, if my own analysis is correct, I believe that the Bormann Organization in particular and the Underground Reich, as I call it in general, will ultimately prove to be victorious and decisive in human affairs, with all that implies. Manning writes, "A man of indescribably vast power and the sole trustee of Hitler's secrets after May 1, 1945 in the Berlin bunker, Bormann continues to be the most controversial, perplexing figure of our times. There are those who wish him dead and continue to claim he is, for, were he to emerge, it would embarrass the governments that assisted in his escape, the industrial and financial leaders who benefited from his acumen and transferred their capital to neutral nations in the closing days of World War II, and the businessmen of four continents who profited from the 750 corporations he established throughout the world as depositories of money, patents, bearer bonds, and shares in blue-chip industries in the United States and Europe. There are also those who know he is not dead, and I am among those who hold this belief. When I penetrated the silence cloaking this story after countless interviews and laborious research in German and American archives for revealing documents of World War II, I knew that the Bormann saga of Flight Capital and his escape to South America was really true. It had been covered up by an unparalleled manipulation of public opinion and the media. The closer I got to the truth, the more quiet attention I received from the forces surrounding and protecting Martin Bormann, and also from those who had a direct interest in halting my investigation. Over the period of years it took to research this book, I was the object of diligent observation by squads of Gestapo agents dispatched from South America by General Gestapo Mueller, capital M-U-E-L-L-E-R, who directs all security matters for Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, and his organization. the most remarkable business group anywhere in the secret world of today. By the way, Heinrich Müller was head of the Gestapo and became the security director for the Underground Reich, the Reich in exile. And as we looked at in a miscellaneous archive show entitled The Flight of the Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler, Heinrich Müller, who also obviously survived the Second World War despite the fact that he was reported to be dead, went to work for U.S. intelligence in the post-World War II period. He also arranged, by the way, Hitler's escape. Again, that documentation in The Flight of the Wolf, a miscellaneous archive show. Continuing with Manning's account, Mueller's interest in me. Now, bear in mind, when Manning refers to the surveillance of him while he was researching and writing the book by squads of Gestapo agents dispatched from South America, bear in mind, this is 1981 that this book was published, and the Gestapo is real in 1981 as it was in 1941. Continuing, Mueller's interest in me, an American journalist, confirmed the truth of my many interviews and my ongoing investigation. Bormann is alive, they don't want waves, so they have been willing to expend immense time and money in tracking me and my progress. There are also those in international government and business who have attempted to stop my forward movement on this investigation. In Germany, France, England, and the United States, too many leaders in government and finance still adhere to Winston Churchill's statement to his cabinet in 1943, quote, "In wartime, truth is so precious that she should always be attended by a bodyguard of lies," unquote. For these leaders act as if the war is still on, especially when they are trying to protect their flanks, their wealth, and their influential peers in government, business, and banking. The West German government fears this story will emerge and will do harm to its growing prestige, which is really the one resounding victory the German nation can point to with pride. Yet, because they are unsure how it will be received by their allies of today, and because many in the Federal Republic of Germany bear the burdens of war guilt, the prudent course, they believe, is silence, and when necessary, the implied intimidation of publishers and literary agents who might be tempted to run with this story. But Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, is a great slice of true history whose time has come for publication. Oddly, I encountered less resistance from Martin Bormann and his aging peers than I did from the cover-up groups in West Germany, Paris, London, Washington, and Wall Street. Bormann knows he is mortal, as are his cronies who have turned over the day-to-day direction of the Bormann organization to a younger leadership. The old guard want the story told, and the only point of friction is whether it should be before or after Fuhrer Bormann's demise. And by the way, we will note at the end of this segment what Manning went through to write this particular book. I would say that Manning's accomplishment in writing this book is as remarkable a journalistic and historical achievement as the Bormann organization was a political, military, and financial achievement. And again, as Manning has noted, Bormann was the architect of this program. Bormann, an organizational genius. Again, the profound connections of the Bormann organization to Germany, the United States, and other countries have led to a cover-up. Manning describes this cover-up in part when he discusses a German statement issued by Reinhard Gehlen, the Nazi spy chief who went to work for U.S. intelligence after the war and then became the German intelligence chief for the Federal Republic. A Gehlen story was floated that maintained that Bormann had gone over to the Soviet Union and was behind the Iron Curtain. Nothing could be further from the truth. Of this rumor, a deliberate disinformation effort, Manning was told, and he writes as follows, "My own West German sources have told me, quote, the CIA was behind the General Gehlen statement. It was a manipulation of public opinion by the CIA, immediately obvious to anyone who knows anything about this subject. Bormann and his links to Germany today are a hidden but a very real political issue." And those links were also the motivating factor for the German government declaring that a corpse which was identified as Bormann's had been found buried in Berlin. In fact, this was a corpse that had been deliberately planted by Heinrich Müller, the brilliant head of the Gestapo. Its dental work had been altered to resemble that of Bormann. Manning writes of this, "Substituting one body for another has been a ploy much used by General Heinrich Müller of the Gestapo. It was he who coordinated the details of Bormann's disappearance. This is according to statements made to me by separate individuals working for three different intelligence services. The Berlin skull is from a body placed in the location of the freight yards on April 30th, 1945, by an SS Gestapo team commanded by General Müller of the Waffen-SS. Their account is retold in Chapter 6. Furthermore, another authority on Borman has since told me in 1977, quote, Borman planned this flight with extreme care, and part of the grand design was a scheme to lead future forensic and dental specialists astray, unquote. The London Daily Express termed the Frankfurt press conference by the Brandt government a whitewash and said it was Borman's passport to freedom in perpetuity, forever freeing him from harassment or a capture. The European press held that a deal was made between representatives of the Borman NSDAP in exile in South America, interrupting, that's the Nazi Party in exile in South America, and the government of the Federal Republic of Germany. Their speculation was that by so doing, the government sought to free itself from the unending, nagging pressure of continuing to search for Borman. And indeed, as Manning notes, the Borman organization essentially was the foundation of the Federal Republic of Germany and its economic prowess. Manning describes the German two-tiered economic system. Bear in mind that this book was published in 1981, when there still was a West and East Germany. Manning writes of the relationship between the Bormann organization and the above-ground German economy. West Germany's economic power structure is fueled by a two-tier system. The corporations and individuals who publicly represent the products that are common household names around the world, and the secretive groups operating in the background as holding companies and who pull the threads of power in overseas corporations established during the Bormann tenure in the Third Reich. As explained to me, quote, these threads are like the strands of a spider's web, and no one knows where they lead except the inner circle of the Bormann organization in South America, unquote. And of the consummate power of the Borman organization, and also the interesting fact that Borman has seen to it that there was select participation by Jewish business leaders in the Borman organization. This also resulted in a profound Borman organization influence upon the world Jewish community. Manning writes as follows. With the war years far behind him, Martin Borman goes on and on, quietly making history in worldwide financial circles. He was 80 on June 17, 1980, and his chief of security, Heinrich Müller, was 79 the same year. Borman today may be likened to the classic chairman of the board of a vast international business complex of an organization holding greater assets than any private investment house on Wall Street. Borman, aged though he is, continues to guide the destiny of his financial empire. But he is sufficiently prudent and foresighted to realize that the assets he controls must be placed in younger hands, and today the leadership council of the senior NSDAP group is reflected in a younger generation comprising professional managers, lawyers, and financiers who are calling the shots as money and trade are moved among the markets of the Americas and Europe. By the way, again, the NSDAP is the Nazi Party. Their organization holds the bearer bonds that give him a voice in banks and industries of Germany. And likewise, they hold blue-chip stocks in U.S. heavy industries and chemical companies. They are represented, too, on the boards of corporations in France, Belgium, Holland, Sweden, Luxembourg, and Switzerland, as well as in a myriad of other countries, including those in their bastion, Latin America. Their management is of the best, and the companies they operate return a profit to everyone involved, from the West German government in corporate taxes and increased trade, to the shareholders of all companies that participated so long ago in Reichsleiter Bormann's flight capital program. Since the founding of Israel, the Federal Republic of Germany had paid out 85.3 billion marks by the end of 1977 to survivors of the Holocaust. East Germany ignores any such liability. From South America, where payment must be made with subtlety, the Bormann organization has made a substantial contribution. It has drawn many of the brightest Jewish businessmen into a participatory role in the development of many of its corporations, and many of these Jews share their prosperity most generously with Israel. If their proposals are sound, they are even provided with a specially dispensed venture capital fund. I spoke with one Jewish businessman in Hartford, Connecticut. He had arrived there quite unknown several years before our conversation, but with Borman money as his leverage. Today, he is more than a millionaire, a quiet leader in the community with a certain share of his profits earmarked, as always, for his venture capital benefactors. This has taken place in many other instances across America and demonstrates how Borman's people operate in the contemporary commercial world, in contrast to the fanciful nonsense with which Nazis are described in so much, quote, literature, unquote. So much emphasis is placed on select Jewish participation in Bormann companies that when Adolf Eichmann was seized and taken to Tel Aviv to stand trial, it produced a shockwave in the Jewish and German communities of Buenos Aires. Jewish leaders informed the Israeli authorities in no uncertain terms that this must never happen again, because a repetition would permanently rupture relations with the Germans of Latin America, as well as with the Bormann organization, and cut off the flow of Jewish money to Israel. It never happened again, and the pursuit of Bormann quieted down at the request of these Jewish leaders. He is residing in an Argentinian safe haven protected by the most efficient German infrastructure in history, as well as by all those whose prosperity depends on his well-being. Personal invitation is the only way to reach him. A revealing insight into this international financial and industrial network was given me by a member of the Bormann organization residing in West Germany. Meyer Lansky, he said, the financial advisor to the Las Vegas-Miami underworld, sent a message to Bormann through my West German SS contact. Lansky promised that if he received a piece of Bormann's action, he would keep the Israeli agents off Bormann's back. Quote, "I have a very good relation with the Israeli secret police," was his claim. Unquote. Although he was to be kicked out, I have a very good relation with the Israeli secret police, unquote, was his claim, although he was to be kicked out of Israel later when his presence became too noted, and also at the urging of Bormann's security chief in South America. At the time, Lansky was in the penthouse suite of Jerusalem's King David Hotel, in which he owned stock. He had fled to Israel to evade a U.S. federal warrant for his arrest. He sent his message to Bormann through his bagman in Switzerland, John Pullman, also wanted in the United States on a federal warrant. Lansky told Pullman to make this offer, quote, "which he can't refuse," unquote. The offer was forwarded to Buenos Aires, where it was greeted with laughter. When the laughter died down, it was replaced with action. Meyer Lansky was evicted from Israel and was told by Swiss authorities to stay out of their country, so he flew to South America. There he offered any president who would give him asylum a cool $1 million in cash. He was turned down everywhere and had to continue his flight to Miami, where U.S. Marshals alerted were waiting to take him into custody. The Bormann organization has the ultimate in clout and substance, and no one can tamper with it. I have been told, quote, "you cannot push these people. If you do, it can be extremely risky," unquote. Knowing their heritage, I take this statement at face value. And the protector of the formidable security of this altogether remarkable organization was, as mentioned above, Heinrich Müller, the head of the Gestapo during the above-ground stage of the Third Reich and also during its underground phase. Of Müller's work for as the security director for the Bormann organization, Manning writes, "As the Führer in exile guards the party treasury and keeps a close eye on the investments and corporations controlled through stock ownership and by the organization, the leadership in position today remains relatively young and viable. It is run as a tight operation insofar as expenses are concerned, and the team of accountants and business representatives who travel twice yearly to Europe to check things out must detail all expenses in the manner of normal corporate procedures anywhere. This team of traveling auditors is accompanied by a covey of protective security guards provided by SS General Müller, who enjoys to this day the title of Reich Minister of the Interior in exile. His teams range far afield, even to the United States, when bottom lines are to be checked out and on-site investments evaluated. It is said that General Müller is utterly paranoid about his possible capture, which is not quite true. As a former inspector of detectives in Munich who became an old Gestapo hand when selected for the job by Heydrich, he learned total caution early, and that is the principle by which he lives today. As security chief for the Nazi organization in South America and Europe, General Müller keeps a close eye on the leadership and on those he feels might threaten them. Israeli agents who move too closely to these centers of power are eliminated. One such termination was Fritz Bauer, formerly attorney general for the state of Hesse in Frankfurt, a survivor of Auschwitz, and the man who tipped off the Israeli Mossad about the presence of Adolf Eichmann in Buenos Aires, was killed on orders of General Müller. His body was found in his bathtub and listed as, quote, "death by heart attack," unquote, by the Frankfurt police. The real cause? Cyanide spray that induces heart stoppage without detection. The same modus operandi that Müller used to kill the Bormann stand-ins who were placed in the Berlin freight yards in late April of 1945. Mueller's ruthlessness even today is what deters Artur Oxmann from altering his testimony that he saw Bormann lying dead on the roadway the night of their escape from the Führer bunker, May 1st and 2nd, 1945. This story had been composed by Mueller. To this day, Oxmann, the only so-called living witness to the, quote, death, unquote, of Bormann in Berlin, knows his life is in jeopardy if he reverses himself. General Mueller is thorough and has a long memory, and for a Nazi such as Oxmann to go against Mueller's original directive would make him a traitor. Retribution would surely follow. When I questioned one SS man who had once worked closely with Bormann in South America about the Oxmann testimony, he said, quote, Oxmann knows Bormann is in South America. I don't know why he persists in lying about the fact. He thought a moment and then went on, quote, but perhaps he wants to go on living, which is reason enough. And still more about Heinrich Mueller's activities as director of security for the Bormann organization. And I would note here that General Galen, that's Reinhard Galen, the Nazi intelligence chief for the Eastern Front in World War II, who jumped to U.S. intelligence, NATO, and then the Federal Republic of Germany with his entire organization intact. Again, a projection forward in time and across the Atlantic of the core of the Third Reich's national security establishment. And also, by the way, a subject I've discussed in the first three RFA shows and that I discuss at great length in RFAs 22 and 37 as well, 37 in particular. Of General Galen's referencing of Heinrich Mueller and his work with him, Manning writes, even General Galen, when he was chief of the Federal Republic's intelligence service, sent his agents to confer with General Heinrich Mueller in South America. The CIA proper, by the way, also worked with the Bormann organization. This described, at least according to Paul Manning, this described by Paul Manning as follows. The Bormann organization had many commercial and political links to the capitals of these three nations, and real clout was available should the chase become too hot. The CIA could have pulled aside the gray curtain that obscured Bormann at any time, but the CIA and Mueller's crack organization of former SS men found it to their mutual advantage to cooperate in many situations. There is no morality in the sense that most of us know it in the strange world of professional secrecy, and when it was to the advantage of each to work together, they did so. And still more about the incredible clout that the Bormann organization wields in Germany, and again, bear in mind that this book was published in 1981. Speaking of Germany, Manning says, pervasive unease remains a characteristic of the nation, despite the stunning material achievements and its enviably solid economy. Perhaps this insecurity has its roots in memories of two sweeping defeats in this century, as well as the strain of having to live with the secrets of the Martin Bormann program for more than four decades, the secrets that enabled the West German leadership to stage one of history's most resounding comebacks in the arena of international commerce. Martin Bormann knows this to be so, and confides to his intimates that while he can never return to Germany, his lines of communication remain ever open. This man, who legally succeeded Hitler, and therefore is the leader of over several million NSDAP members in South America and Germany, demonstrated the ultimate in clout in 1971 when he summoned the president of the Federal Republic of Germany, then Walter Scheel, and the latter's wife Mildred to Bolivia, whence they quickly returned to Europe with a newly adopted one-year-old boy who bore the first name Simon Martin. The child, now 11 years of age, is being reared and educated in one of Germany's most influential families. The belief is, of course, that he is a son of Martin Bormann, who insisted that this child of his old age be brought up as an upper-class German in his fatherland and receive appropriate advantages befitting a son of the leading Nazi. Is Martin Bormann proud of his achievement? Indeed he is. A man of many moods, which can be traced to an exile of 35 years from his homeland and suffering the physical vagaries that go with a robust but 80-year-old body, he turns cheerful when commenting on the economic leadership of the Federal Republic of Germany. He didn't do it all, he admits, but the economic bastions of power that he established in the neutral countries of the world in 1944 were the bedrock enabling the West German government to rise from defeat once they had again become masters of their destiny after the Treaty of Paris in 1954. The Bormann organization continues to wield enormous economic influence. Wealth continues to flow into the treasuries of its corporate entities in South America, the United States, and Europe. Vastly diversified, it is said to be the largest landowner in South America, and through stock holdings controls German heavy industry and the trust established by the late Hermann Schmitz, former president of I.G. Farben, who held as much stock in Standard Oil of New Jersey as did the Rockefellers. In 1980, Chancellor Helmut Schmidt said West Germany was the greatest commercial and financial power in the world today after the United States. He declared that West Germany's economic strength was its essential international lever. Quote, "For some years now, our economic policy has been simultaneously our foreign policy," unquote. This theme delights Borman as he talks with intimates in the well-guarded privacy of his pompous ranch house. A former CIA contract pilot who once flew the run into Paraguay and Argentina to the Borman ranch described the estate as remote, quote, "worth your life unless you entered their airspace with the right identification codes," unquote. And again, as I have noted, just as the Borman organization is arguably the most remarkable financial, political, and military accomplishment, certainly of modern history, perhaps of all time, so too the writing of this book represents arguably the most remarkable journalistic and historical achievement of all time, and one that was a very brave undertaking by Paul Manning. His writing of this book is described in Martin Borman, Nazi in Exile, as follows. "That there is a Borman organization is unquestionably true. I know from personal experience. During years of research for this book, I have become aware of Heinrich Mueller and his security force, which provides protection for the leadership in Latin America and wherever else they may travel to Europe and to the United States to check on investments and profits. Through intermediaries, I have attempted unceasingly to penetrate to the central core of the organization in South America, but have been denied access. At the last meeting that I know about, it was voted, quote, Herr Manning's writing would focus undue attention on our activities, and his request must once again be denied, unquote. The elderly leaders, including Reichsminister Borman, who is now 80, wanted me on the scene to write of their side of the story, above all his story, of one of the most amazing and successful financial and industrial cloaking actions in history, of which he is justifiably proud. I had sent word to Borman that the true story, his first-hand account, should become a matter of historical record, and stated that I would be agreeable to writing it if I could tell his true story, warts and all. Back came the word, quote, You are a free world journalist and can write as you think best. We, too, are interested only in truth, unquote. They agreed to my request to bring along a three-man camera crew from CBS News to film my conversations with Martin Borman, and even approved my wish for at least a personal thumbprint of the former Reichsleiter and party minister, which would be positive proof of his identity. At the organization's request, I sent the background, names, photos, and credentials of the particular CBS cameramen. Lawrence Walter Pierce, Richard Henry Perez, and Odin Lester Kitzmiller, an award-winning camera crew which got the exclusive coverage of the attempted assassination of Governor George Wallace when he was running for president. I am sorry to say that the younger leaders, the ones now in virtual command, voted no. They did agree, however, that 232 historical documents from World War II, which Borman had shipped out of Berlin in the waning days of the war, and which are stored in his archives in South America, could be sent to me anonymously to be published. They said their lengthy investigation of me had produced confidence that I was an objective journalist as well as a brave one, for their probing stretched back to World War II days and up to the present. Heinrich Mueller, now 79 years old, who also serves as keeper of these archives as well as chief of all security for the NSDAP, rejected this decision. When the courier reached the Buenos Aires International Airport bearing these documents for me, he was relieved of them by the Argentine secret police, acting under an initiative from Mueller. As Mueller had explained previously, he had nothing against me personally. I had been cleared of any, quote, strange connections, unquote, by his agents in New York City, whose surveillance efforts were supplemented by the old pros of the Gestapo up from South America to assist in watching me. This continued intermittently for years, and efforts were stepped up in response to the intensity of my investigations. The statement I had originally made to the representatives in West Germany, that I was only a diligent journalist trying to dig out an important story, finally proved satisfactory to them. I observed that Mueller hadn't lost his touch in the field of surveillance, judging by the quality, skill, and number of men and women who tracked me at what must have been enormous cost wherever I went in New York City, Washington, and overseas. And if this seems like a strange account to people, just bear in mind the reason why one does not hear more about the Borman organization, which apparently to a certain extent tacitly sanctioned the writing of the Manning book. The reason that one does not hear about this organization is described by Manning. The Borman organization has the ultimate in clout and substance, and no one can tamper with it. I have been told, quote, you cannot push these people. If you do, it can be extremely risky. Knowing their heritage, I take this statement at face value. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening. Listening to the KFJC Month of Mayhem Memorial Day Weekend Special, Uncle Sam and the Swastika. We've been doing this since 1981, and we're doing it tonight up till 10 o'clock. This is the story of the collaboration between American corporations and the fascist powers of World War II, and the profound and ongoing significance of that event and its aftermath. What we're going to do next is to listen to a pair of half-hour segments which were recorded in February of 1998, which not only touch again on the subject of the Bormann Organization, but which also talks about the same transatlantic financial and industrial axis, the same one, so the same corporate entities to a large extent, that elevated and armed Hitler and Mussolini, and also the Japanese to an extent, did something very similar with Saddam Hussein. You're also going to hear some excerpts in this pair of half-hour segments from the original Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast from May 23rd, 1980. The first of these segments, both of these segments actually, are a half hour in length. So those of you who are taping, please get ready to do so. 3, 2, 1, here we go. Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in this next half-hour segment, we're going to take a look at a subject that I've dealt with before on other half-hour segments and also in a long interview with Drs. Alan Cantwell, Leonard Horowitz, Garth Nicholson, and Ed Haslam, author of Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, namely Gulf War Syndrome. At the same time, we're going to be revisiting the very first of my archive programs that I did on May 23rd, 1980. That program is entitled Uncle Sam and the Swastika. The title of the broadcast, the focus, I should say, of the program is Gulf War Syndrome. And we're going to begin by taking a look at an article from the New York Times of Tuesday, November 18th of 1997. This article is by Alan Cowell, C-O-W-E-L-L, of the New York Times. It's datelined Bonn, November 17th of 1997, and is headlined, German Official Spied for Iraq in Gulf War. Shortly after, the article reads in part as follows, shortly after Saddam Hussein's army marched into Kuwait in August of 1990, a German foreign ministry official provided Baghdad with piles of secrets, including Western assessments of Iraq's missile strength. The German official, who also gave Iraq critical insights into the increasing deployment of United States forces, was eventually arrested and convicted of espionage, according to confidential documents from his trial. The documents suggest that President Hussein had far greater knowledge in 1990 of American and Allied thinking than was publicly assumed at the time. And the information provided by the German spy may have helped Iraq protect from Allied air attack some of the missiles it used to attack Israel in 1991, the court documents say. By the way, I would also add parenthetically that it may also have permitted the Iraqis to launch some airburst scuds, some of which some Gulf War veterans believe may have helped to infect them with CBW agents, including the genetically altered mycoplasma that the doctors Garth and Nancy Nicholson have discovered is involved in Gulf War syndrome. Continuing, the spy, Jürgen Mohammed Geitler, G-I-E-T-L-E-R, 42, is said to have given an Iraqi intelligence officer in Bonn details of a confidential message from President George Bush to Chancellor Helmut Kohl that set out United States military deployments in the Persian Gulf. in the Persian Gulf region. He also handed over a German intelligence report setting out what the West knew about the location of Iraqi Scud B missile sites, according to the court documents. In other words, President Hussein had time to relocate missile launchers or replace them with decoys long before the beginning of Allied air raids against Iraq in January of 1991. Quote, "The subsequent course of the war, the targeting of heavily populated residential areas of Israel by Iraqi rockets, shows the great significance of this report for Iraq and for the coalition against it," unquote, the documents say. Bonn has a reputation as a place easily penetrated by hostile intelligence agencies. But even by those standards, Mr. Geithler's dealings with an Iraqi military intelligence officer seem to have been made easy by extraordinarily lax security arrangements at the foreign ministry where he worked in the registry where documents are stored. I do not know if Klaus Kinkel, former head of BND, was in charge of the foreign ministry at that time, but one of the possibilities I think should be very seriously considered is perhaps that individual, when he was prosecuted, simply received a wrist slap and may have been functioning in an official capacity for the German national security establishment. I have touched on that speculative element because there is a history of support for Middle Eastern nationalist movements, including Pan-Arabist nationalist movements by Germany, certain Pan-Arabist movements, including the movement led by Haj Amin al-Husseini, the first leader of the Palestinian National Movement, who was also an SS officer and a German spy. Some of those Middle Eastern nationalist movements found a common cause with the Third Reich prior to and during World War II, because they had the common goals of not only getting Great Britain out of the Middle East, Great Britain being the dominant colonial power in that area, but also impeding or eliminating Zionism. That common goal led to not only some formal alliances between elements of the Third Reich and elements of Middle Eastern nationalist movements, but it also led to a certain extent to the development of the Ba'athist Party in Iraq. That was discussed in a book called The Death Lobby, How the West Armed Iraq. That book was authored by Kenneth R. Timmerman, T-I-M-M-E-R-M-A-N, who writes for, among other publications, The Wall Street Journal, or who has. The book was published in hardcover and copyright 1991, and it was published by Houghton Mifflin and Company. The ISBN number is 0-395-59305-0. And of the affinity between and, to a certain extent, ideological alliance between the Third Reich and the Ba'athist Party, a pan-Arabist party, and that obviously the party in Iraq headed up by Saddam Hussein, the author writes as follows. Unlike Europe, the Middle East was not transformed into a pile of smoldering rubble by World War II. The Nazi conflagration left Arab dreams and Arab resentments intact. By the time he was 8, Saddam had already marshaled the boys of his village into a mock militia that marched up and down the dusty streets of Tikrit, T-I-K-R-I-T, with wooden guns. At 10, he found a mentor in his maternal uncle, Khairala al-Tulfa, a recently cashiered army officer whose hatred of British colonial rule was matched only by his admiration for Adolf Hitler and his Nazi ideals. By the way, that man's last name, A-L-T-U-L-F-A-H. More about him later. Saddam turned to his uncle at least in part because of problems at home. His father had deserted the family when Saddam was a young child, and his mother's second husband, an illiterate shepherd named Ibrahim Hassan, beat the boy whenever he refused to tend a sheep. When he was 12, Saddam took refuge in his uncle Khairala's house. He learned to read by the light of an oil lamp and fed his spirit on his uncle's tales of exploits with pro-German officers in the Iraqi army. Khairala al-Tufa had a dream that Arabs would one day be free of foreign occupation and foreign rule. The Germans, Khairala said, were the only ones who respected the Arabs as equals. The British were just after their oil. Skipping down, the Ba'ath Party, or the Party of Arab Renaissance, called for the creation of a single Arab political union that would reach from North Africa to the border of Iran. Formed in 1947 in response to the emerging state of Israel, the party fired the imagination of many young Iraqis like Saddam Hussein al-Tikriti. For the young Ba'athists, the event that forever fixed their way of looking at the world was, quote, the takeover of Palestine by international Zionism, unquote. As one Ba'athist writer put it, the influx of Jews to Palestine during the Holocaust in Europe, quote, was bound to generate a great deal of bitterness, resentment, and hostility. This sort of feeling naturally led certain sectors of the Arab public opinion to sympathize with the Axis powers, unquote. British colonialism bore immense responsibility for the, quote, disaster, unquote, of Palestine, the Ba'athists felt, and in their speeches and ideological writings, they consistently identified the two. Quote, "It is our unshakable belief," unquote, the founder of the Ba'ath Party, Michel Aflaq, M-A-F-L-A-K, wrote in 1956, again quoting, "that if the battle takes place sooner or later, it will be to liberate not Palestine alone, but the whole of the Arab homeland."